You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton. Chad Lampe is out this week. This past Friday, WKMS News hosted a live forum with the candidates vying for Kentucky's 3rd District State House seat. Paducah City Commissioner Gerald Watkins is the Democratic candidate. He faces Republican Jason Crockett this fall. The two offered their takes on several issues: tax reform, infrastructure improvement, the state's business environment, and the role of government. This has been edited for time. The full version is online at WKMS.org. Today, we bring you a rebroadcast of that discussion. Mr. Watkins, tell us a little bit about what got you into this race.
I'm a college professor, a professor of political science, have been for 22 years. I'm serving my 3rd term on the Paducah City Commission. Politics is my first love. I've always been intrigued and wanted to participate and try to contribute and make Western Kentucky, Paducah, and McCracken County more specifically a better place to live. I'm real proud of my record on the Paducah City Commission. I've never voted to increase any taxes. I voted against the permanent increase in the city payroll tax. I voted to cut property taxes twice. And I've voted 100% for economic incentives that have created and/or retained nearly 2,000 jobs just in the nearly 6 years that I've been on the Paducah City Commission, and that equates to approximately $90 million in new private capital investment. And so there's just a lot you can do to improve the quality of life of people, and I would like to take that experience, energy, my education, and go to Frankfort and work at a higher level to try to improve the lives of all Kentuckians, and certainly specifically Western Kentucky and Paducah and McCracken County.
Mr. Crockett.
Well, I'm a business guy. That's what I've done my entire adult life. I've worked in the private sector. In fact, I work at a private radio station, and I see a lot of business people every day. And when I see these business people, they're struggling. The economy has taken a real big hit on these people. The reason why I got into this race is simply because I think we can do things better. We talk a lot about creating jobs. We talk a lot about creating opportunity. Well, we cannot create jobs if we don't first create an atmosphere conducive to the growth of businesses. One of the problems is our corporate tax rate in Kentucky is 6%. You know, I was at a meeting last night, and we were talking about economic development for Paducah, and there was kind of a debate as to whether or not it has economic development projects have been successful or not. I'm not want to get in that debate, but without some help from the levels in Frankfort, getting off of some of these high taxes and some of these terrible regulations that are stifling businesses, we're not going to see job growth. It's just it's not going to happen, and it can't happen. So my standpoint all along has been that we've got to put our arms around and reach out and hug small businesses so that we, for lack of a better term, so that we can actually help them to grow so that they will hire people. And we've got to stop taxing them so much and actually making it hard for them to grow new jobs and grow their businesses.
Well, Mr. Crockett, let me follow up with that. Do you see that as the central issue of this campaign?
Absolutely. The central issue of this campaign is getting people to work. And it's getting people to a place where they are more comfortable with their own personal economy. So it's absolutely the central issue. It's not just jobs. It's good jobs, and it's jobs that are sustainable, and it's creating opportunity for the people of District 3 and the state of Kentucky.
Mr. Watkins, so what do you see as the central issue of the campaign?
Well, Jason's absolutely correct. It's jobs. So many people have had to leave Western Kentucky and Paducah and McCracken County in particular over the years, over the decades. We have got to try to do everything we possibly can to make Paducah and McCracken County and Western Kentucky an attractive place for people to do business, and certainly the tax code needs to be revised. There are a lot of things already in place. One, communities, if you look at cities across the country that are growing, they're located on a major interstate. We have 3 major interstates. We're at the confluence of 4 rivers. Paducah, Kentucky is now the inland waterways capital of the country. We have 24 barge companies whose national headquarters are, in the case of Ingram, regional, but more employees work here than their national headquarters in Nashville. 24 barge companies basically headquartered in Paducah, Kentucky. We have air. We have 3 railroads coming through here. We're centrally located. We're within an 8-hour drive of 70% of the U.S. population. So we've got everything in place. We need a more business-friendly tax code, and we needed a 4-year university presence here. Communities that are growing have a 4-year university presence. We have never had that. Now, finally, well, we do have a 4-year engineering agreement with the University of Kentucky on our campus, and now with the 2+2 with Murray State University, Paducah, Kentucky is now a university town. Now that we have the 2+2 4-year university presence, or when it opens in about a year, the governor's office has sent us numerous leads. You have to work through the governor's office to land these big prospects that are interested in your state. And we've landed some, and we're getting ready to land several more that will employ a lot of people. And you have to provide incentive money. And I voted 100% for the incentive money necessary to land these companies and get the 4-year university presence here with Murray State University also. That's critical.
Let's go right to the tax issue. Governor Steve Beshear's Blue Ribbon Tax Commission is set to deliver its recommendations to the governor next month. Mr. Watkins, is there something that you, in particular, that you would like to see in that report?
Yes. One, I'm anxious to see the recommendations from the task force. I have a lot of confidence in that task force because, well, John Williams Sr. is on it, Bob Leeper and the Lieutenant Governor, along with a lot of very talented, bright people from all across the state. But we do need a more business-friendly tax code. The corporate tax rate is way too high. Me personally, I would like to abolish the state income tax and replace that with generating revenue from a sales tax. There are 8 states in the country that do not have a state income tax. Texas does not. They're the fastest growing state in the country and have been for a number of years. I'm not suggesting we tax services, but to abolish the state income tax and look at the state sales tax to generate the revenue necessary to remain revenue neutral is what we need to do. You don't want to raise taxes. You want to remain revenue neutral, but a tax code that will grow with the economy. And if you replicate Texas percentage according to their GDP, the same level of taxation, sales taxation in Kentucky would generate $5.5 billion out of about $9.5 billion needed each year to balance the budget. So I think that would probably fill that gap, but we'll look at more specific numbers. But that is was something that I think I would like to very seriously look at doing in Kentucky.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of last Friday's Candidate Forum with 3rd District Statehouse candidates Gerald Watkins and Jason Crockett. Mr. Crockett, is there anything that you want to see in those recommendations?
Well, absolutely. And I think that the idea of abolishing an income tax is kind of it's an interesting idea, but we use words like revenue neutral. Why would we change our tax system if we didn't need more money? That's unfortunately, and I believe that Mr. Watkins is very genuine in wanting to help, but revenue neutral is not really an option. Really, the bottom line is people want to change our tax code so that there's more money for bureaucrats in Frankfurt to spend. That's first off. The services that would be taxed in order to actually make that difference, because you got to keep in mind a sales tax increase is an attack on poor people, because right now, extremely poor people who don't pay in our income taxes, okay? So we're going to take their money and let their spending power even less because they're going to have to be paying higher taxes on things like milk and bread and whatever else. I'm not necessarily for that. The only way to make a sales tax situation work and be a benefit is to tax services, and I am totally against taxing services. Like realtors, makes the cost of the American dream more expensive. That's a service that would be taxed under some people's proposals. Doctors, you would have to tax those doctors, but I don't think that making medical care more expensive is a good thing. And lawyers, while I don't necessarily, I think that lawyers make plenty of money. I think that when we make justice more expensive for people who are defending themselves in criminal situations and whatnot, I believe that's a bad idea and a bad approach too. Now, in fairness, and Mr. Watkins did mention that he didn't want to tax the services, but the bottom line is we would have to, in order to make a sales tax to be beneficial. There is, again, I'll reiterate, there's no reason to change our tax code unless it's to make more money. for the state coffers. Another thing that I would like to mention on this topic is that, yes, we have a 6% tax rate for corporate taxes in Kentucky. Historically, if we cut that tax rate, we're actually going to get more revenue off of it because we'll be able to attract more people. By all means, my opponent, Gerald, he knows that in state government, trying to attract these businesses has been tough, probably because of our corporate tax rates. Another reason why it's been tough is because the city of Paducah has this crazy tax on insurance premiums and income taxes that are pretty high, which my opponent voted against the income tax, but at least the raising of the income tax. But the bottom line is it's probably been very tough, as he can admit, because they have worked hard to try to get economic development in Paducah. I'm not trying to take that away from anybody. But it starts in the levels in Frankfort. We've got to get things under control in Frankfort to make it easier for the economic development people in Paducah.
One, I would not favor the taxing food, as we do not in Kentucky right now. Certain foods that are tax exempt, we should maintain that. And I'm not suggesting we start taxing services. But we could shift more of the tax revenue that collected away from state income to sales tax. There are a couple of things that these are near and dear to my heart, and these are the things I really want to do if I do get elected, that would decrease state spending substantially. One, Kentucky needs to pass a welfare reform bill. We have never done that. Medicaid is the fastest growing part of the Kentucky budget. We're never going to balance the federal budget, and I favor a balanced budget amendment. We're never going to balance the federal budget nor stabilize Kentucky's budget unless we address entitlement spending. Well, I start with the premise that the elderly, the disabled, the infirm, we have an obligation morally and financially to take care of these people. But people of working age and able body to have a moral and financial responsibility to take care of themselves. But you can't just lop them off. So you give them 5 years. Here's an opportunity, government expense. Do everything you can to help people become marketable, productive, so they can join the economic mainstream and support themselves. The second fastest growing part of the Kentucky budget is corrections, $500 million budget. And it's grown 60% in the last 12 years. What I would like to do in that area quickly is repeal House Bill 463, which makes it difficult for law enforcement to do their jobs. If you look at national figures, 53% of the people who are in our prisons are in there on drug charges. I think for personal possession of illicit drugs, one does not belong in prison. I think mandatory treatment on their dime, if they meet an income level to actually do that, and the faith-based community should be able to participate in that treatment, and then community service. That should be the options. They don't belong in prison. Use that space for violent criminals. I think we need to find a constitutional way to put a cap on appeals. The death penalty, there's 35 men on death row in Kentucky. 15 have been there over 20 years. The longest served, 28 years, and died of natural causes. Costs over $31,000 a year to keep someone on death row. Corrections budget is growing, like I say, the second fastest in the entire state. And we need to address the criminal code, save the prison space for the violent offenders. And those two put together will save Kentucky's taxpayers an awful lot of money. And we could balance, I think, you know, we could balance the budget and not have to have any tax increases at all.
Mr. Crockett, closing statement.
My closing statement would be that same people have been in charge in Frankfort since the 1920s, basically, which Gerald happens to be a part of. Those people have sent him a lot of money for his campaign, and they really want him to win. And the reason why is because they assume that when Gerald Watkins gets to Frankfort, he's going to vote for a guy named Greg Stumbo for Speaker of the House. And if that happens, nothing is going to change. Gerald has some great ideas, and Gerald's a nice guy, but Gerald's not going to get anything done that Greg Stumbo doesn't want him to do if Greg Stumbo is the Speaker of the House. An example would be pro-life legislation that was bargained and everything was set up, ready to go. They were going to put it to a vote, and it would have passed, but Greg Stumbo stopped it in its tracks. Didn't happen. Another example would be all of our pension problems that we have in the state of Kentucky right now. These are problems that were caused by the same people that are in charge now. Every single problem the state of Kentucky has can be directly attributed to these exact people who are asking basically for us to put them back in charge in Frankfort. If you think that we've got problems, if you think our tax code needs to be changed, if you think that anything we've talked about here needs to be done, if you think that anything needs to change in the state of Kentucky, then you have to vote for Republicans. I hate to make it partisan, but it's just a fact. And I happen to be a Republican. I know that when I get to Frankfort, I will not vote for Greg Stumbo for Speaker of the House. And I'm hoping that you will vote for change. I'm asking for your vote on November 6th, and I would be honored to serve.
Mr. Watkins.
Thank you, Todd, and thank you, Jason. I do appreciate that. And Jason's a gentleman. He's a very intelligent young man. I've enjoyed this campaign and getting to know him, and I do consider him a friend, and I think we'll be friends after this is over with. One, I would first say that I established myself as an independent voice on the Paducah City Commission, not a puppet of anyone or aligning myself with any particular group. I'm a very conservative, I think pragmatic individual who looks at each issue on its merits. I'm like Jason, I'm pro-life. I'm a member of the Kentucky Right to Life Association. As far as in Frankfort, a lot of people feel like if the House goes Republican, David Williams will be running the show, and most people feel like he's the biggest detriment to progress in the entire state of Kentucky. And so I'm not so sure that that would be the solution, but I have a very working relationship with the governor. He's been very good to Paducah McCracken County. And I'm not beholden to any one particular person in the House of Representatives. I'm going to vote my conscience. I don't aspire to leadership, and the people who elect me, I answer to the people in Paducah and McCracken County. And so I think I'll be in a position with my education, energy experience, in contacts, to be a very effective leader for the people of Paducah and McCracken County, to make this a better place to live, provide greater opportunities, and vote your values. So I would love to have your support and vote on November 6th for Gerald Watkins for 3rd District State Representative.
Democrat Gerald Watkins and Republican Jason Crockett are running for Kentucky's 3rd District State House seat. Gentlemen, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having us, and I appreciate you opening up your airwaves so that we could get our messages out.
You can hear the full version of this discussion at WKMS.org. On next week's forum, we'll hear from the candidates for Kentucky's 4th District State House seat, Republican Lynn Beckler and Democrat Raymond Janina. If you have questions for the candidates, you can post them to our Facebook page, tweet them to @WKMS, or email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. When we come back, a conversation with a master distiller who's the guest of honor at this year's upcoming Distiller's Dinner at the Carson Center in Paducah. And we'll get a look ahead to this year's River's Edge Film Festival with Maiden Alley Cinema Executive Director Landy Bryant. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton. 72-year-old Lincoln Henderson is described as a distinguished-looking man with a tidy white goatee and a wry smile. Former master distiller for Brown-Forman, Mr. Henderson helped develop Woodford Reserve, Jack Daniel's Gentleman Jack, and Jack Daniel's Single Barrel. Now he's spearheading new craft distiller, the Louisville Distilling Company, whose 86.6-proof small-batch bourbon Angel's Envy is the star of the Carson Center's 8th Annual Distiller Dinner on Saturday, October 27th. Kate Lochte talked with Henderson about his craft.
A review said that Angel's Envy is big and smooth with almost an oatmeal cookie taste plus hints of pipe tobacco.
Holy mackerel.
And I'm wondering how you describe Angel's Envy other than it's good.
It's good. One of my best friends at Brown-Forman was Jimmy Bedford, who was the master distiller for Jack Daniel's. And he would do tastings and stuff, and that's what he said, now you look at this and this is the color. Look at the color. Isn't that nice? And taste it. Isn't that good? We go into it a little more depth, but I have probably 10 or 15 descriptors that I go by, because there are probably hundreds that you can pick out, and different people will pick out different things. You know, if somebody describes it with tobacco and oatmeal cookie or whatever, good for them, because in a bourbon whiskey, it's probably the most complex of any of the spirits made because of the fact that it's stored in new charred white oak, and that just changes the whole flavor profile compared to other whiskeys around the world. That new white oak barrel actually contributes so many different spice notes. It contributes like vanilla, caramel, maple, And these are all things that are readily experienced by most people that will drink the bourbon. But now you can sit down and go over it and over it and start picking up different notes, but that's not typical of a consumer. You just don't want anything in there that tastes bad. Let's put it that way.
But you've changed the paradigm, apparently, in what kind of barrel you're putting it in.
First of all, it has to become bourbon. It has to abide by all the government regulations that are required for us to call it bourbon. And one of those things is a new charred white oak barrel, which no other whiskey in the world is required to use. And no, I can't think of, sometimes I think the Canadians fool around with it a little bit, but it totally changes the nature of their whiskey, so they don't continue to do that on a large basis. But you have to do that first. It has to be meet all the requirements for bourbon, which the first one has to be made in the United States, and most of it is made in Kentucky. I'd say probably 95% of it is made in Kentucky. Of course, the best bourbon is made in Kentucky. And then it has to be distilled at less than 80% alcohol or less. And then after that, it has to be put in a new charred white oak barrel. And you can leave it in that barrel as long as you want to. There's no actual age requirement on leaving it in that barrel unless if you want to be able to call it straight bourbon, it has to be in there 2 years. But other than that, there's no, you know, whether 10 years, 15 years or whatever. So once you do that, you can take it out of that barrel once it becomes bourbon, and you can put it in any kind of container you want to. And that's what I did experimenting with for 2 or 3 years before I retired from Brown-Forman. They decided that they didn't want to go with it. So when my son proposed starting this company up and he said, I'd like for you to make the whiskey, I had a pretty good idea what I'd like to do to make it totally different from any other bourbon out there. And that's what the port finish does.
So describe the process you innovated.
To start with, I wanted to make a bourbon that was really much more subtle and much lighter than any other bourbon out there, and especially any one that I'd ever made, because the requirements for the bourbons that I made for Brown-Forman were that it had to have a lot of wood, and that was just the style of whiskey that Brown-Forman made. But I experienced doing tastings throughout the world that a lot of people did not really want an aggressive bourbon, or they didn't care for it, especially women. So I figured, you know, we'll just start out making a very light bourbon all the way around and then put it in the barrel only long enough to pick up the vanilla notes that I want, the really heavy vanilla and caramel notes, and didn't leave it there any longer than that to where it starts to pick up too much wood and become woody. So that's what we did, and that took about 4.5 years, and we're looking at 4 to 6 years because you can't really just say that I'm going to keep it under 4.5 years, but it could take longer, maybe 5 years or 5.5. But we want to take it out of the barrel just before it becomes woody, and then once you put it in that freshly dumped port wine barrel, it actually starts to absorb some of that port, but we didn't want it to taste like port. We just wanted that port to modify the alcohol bite in the bourbon and to soften that woodiness that you get from the barrel. So that's basically what it does. And we leave it in there for, well, anywhere from 3 to 6 months, depending on how it matures.
And your first bottling was when?
It was a year ago this past April. Actually bottled in March, but then we introduced it in Kentucky a year ago in April, because Kentucky had to be the first state. That's a given. And then we branched out into like 17 other states now after a year and a half. And we're just so excited about how the consumer has accepted this bourbon.
It sounds like it has been one of the fastest starts ever.
Oh, it is, because I've been involved in a lot of startups, and the last one I was involved with was Woodford Reserve. It actually took about 6 years to really take off and start to grow, whereas Angel's Envy just took off right away, and it's still growing leaps and bounds. I kind of cross my fingers and hope that keeps doing that. I feel confident we have a lot of customers that we haven't introduced it to yet. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I understand that your son sort of prodded you back into the business so that his sons could learn from you.
Yes, Wes has six boys, and the oldest one, Kyle, is actually our production manager. He's 22, and he's still working on finishing up his degree in chemistry, which is what I did, and I was totally shocked when he decided he'd like to get in the business because he never voiced that, you know, that desire. And the same way with my son, and then all of a sudden I retire and I'm perfectly happy retired working for Suntory International as a consultant. Then they approached me about starting this business, and here we are. That started about 7 years ago.
Well, your website is most amusing. I'm intrigued with the references to you as someone who sneers at tradition, a malcontent, and a raging perfectionist.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I thought I was soft-spoken and very forgiving. And now, I tell you, I was very fortunate to work for a company for 39 years that I just learned so much. Because in our business, becoming a master distiller, it's a mentoring process. And I had one of the finest people in the business that I studied under. He had somebody that he studied under, and it just for, different generations. And so before I retired, I was very fortunate to have a young fellow study under me, Chris Morris, to take over for Brown-Forman. And he's now the master distiller.
And you're an inaugural member of the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. It's all PR stuff. That's all.
Well, listen, Debbie Wattier at the Carson Center said that your sons are possibly cooking up some handcrafted items for Angel's Envy to have at the auction during the dinner.
Oh, really? I've got to talk to my son and my grandson. They pull this stuff on me. They say, okay, Grandpa, this is what you're going to do. But I think I have an idea what he has cooked up. It's really exciting. Actually, something that we're going to be coming out with on a very limited basis around the holiday season. So it'll be a nice surprise for everybody.
So may I ask you who designed the lovely bottle?
Let's go back to the beginning, about 7 years ago. When my son, he was in Florida, and he was very well situated, and he's in Florida with his six boys and wonderful wife. And he shows up with this guy named Jay Malby, who had retired as the CEO of Krazan Rum, which was one of the major rums. And he had, before he took that over, he was with Bacardi as a CFO. After he left Krazan Rum, he started his own business. Did distribution company, salespeople, and he had some of his own brands, and they came up and started talking to me about starting this bourbon company, and I said, you guys are crazy, and I told Jay, I said, you know what it takes to start a bourbon company? It takes a lot of money and a lot of time and putting whiskey away, and so about 3 or 4 weeks later, they came back up and said, we're ready to go. If I'm interested in joining them, that's how the whole thing started. The whole team, which includes some people with a company out in Colorado called Crisp & Porter, which is one of the major creative companies in the world, and a couple of their guys wanted to get involved in this. They said, look, you just tell us how bourbon's made and give us the story and all this and that, and we talked for hours and hours, and one of the things that came up, of course, was the angel share. You know, you lose whiskey every year, mm-hmm. and supposedly it goes to the angels. I think maybe the devil gets some of it, but then they took off, and a little bit later they presented us with a mock-up on a bottle, which is the bottle we have today, and then the name, Angel's Envy. And I said, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard of. In a bottle, that's not a bourbon bottle. That looks like a perfume bottle. Well, that just shows you, when you're too close to something for 39 years and you're kind of limited in your imagination. But that's what we went with, and it's been a big hit. And I really love it. And my wife loves it, and everybody that sees the bottle, they just say, you know, wow, this is a great bottle. But the bottle is actually made in Europe and shipped to Canada to be decorated, you know, with all the logo and stuff. And the corks come from Portugal, the port wine barrels come from Portugal, and the best part, though, comes from Kentucky, and that's the bourbon. Mm. So that's how that all started.
So Angel's Envy is something you thought about for a while. Do you have anything else up your sleeve to come? Is there some other quest that you have, a personal quest?
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah.
What do you want to do next?
Well, let's put it this way. I've experimented with so many different. We're looking at finishes now, and because I was involved with the tequila people and with the single malt people and with the Japanese and with the Canadians and all that stuff, and there's a lot of things that I experimented with that we're ready to go with as soon as we get Angel's Envy, you know, our flagship brand. Established. Well, we're not going to do too much until we make sure that we're where we want to be with Angel's Envy. But I've got tons of things in the cooker. It's just going to be some exciting years if I last long enough.
Well, hang in there, and thank you for speaking with me.
Okay, well, thank you for calling.
Mr. Lincoln Henderson's Angel's Envy Bourbon inspires the 8th Annual Distiller Dinner of the Carson Center in Paducah on Saturday, October 27th. In addition to Mr. Henderson being there in person to tell a story, the dinner features catering by Laura Duff's A Pampered Palate and a silent auction featuring table and barrel heads created from Angel's Envy. Reservations are available through thecarsoncenter.org or by calling 270-443-9932. Proceeds benefit the Carson Center. The River's Edge International Film Festival starts November 1st in Paducah. Now in its 8th year, the festival has worked to develop what the official website calls dedication to the serious filmmaker, the serious film lover, and the art of cinema. The 4-day event offers short and feature-length films of all varieties. The films this year come from the U.S. and countries around the world, including Russia, the U.K., Spain, Palestine, and Japan. Maiden Alley Cinema Executive Director Landy Bryant spoke with Angela Hatton about this year's River's Edge Film Festival.
I imagine you are very busy right now getting everything started for this festival. It's become quite an event in Paducah.
It absolutely has. We're very proud to be the second longest running film festival in the entire state of Kentucky. So we've been trudging along since 2005. This year, it'll be the first year we have more than one juror, which by definition means three gentlemen are coming, traveling to Paducah to join us and watch all of these films and judge them and awards and give awards accordingly.
And as we've said, you know, the festival has become well established and there are multiple venues and a lot of events also going on in conjunction with it, after parties going on in the downtown area of Paducah. So obviously it's become a significant event for Western Kentucky, but I'm kind of curious, you know, outside of our little scope of region here in the film festival world, how is the River's Edge Film Festival being viewed, you know, among its peers?
Well, we get lots of feedback. We haven't always had as many filmmakers actually travel to Paducah during the festival as we have the past couple years. And this year we're on track to have about 15 to 20 filmmakers coming from all over the United States and the world. We've got some people traveling from the United Kingdom to come to Paducah. They like to come, see their film, talk to the people that see their film, and usually do a question and answer session so that after you view the film, you can get the perspective of the people that made it, which is invaluable. But the people that do travel here usually submit in festivals all over the United States. We've had several that come every year and just fall in love with Paducah. They come for the festival, but they really fall in love with the community.
And how are the films chosen? Is there a vetting process they go through before they actually get into the festival?
There There is. It is a long process. We start in January screening the films that are submitted. We get between, it's ranged over the years from between 200 to 500 submissions.
Oh, wow.
And we show between 46 to 50 films during the weekend. As you mentioned in the other venues, the Iser Arts Center and the Market House Studio Theater graciously let us use their space to be part of the festival.
And what kinds of films do you receive, and what's the quality been of the films that you've received, you know, as you've grown over the last few years?
It's really grown. I mean, we get all facets. We get some really, really good attempts at filmmaking that don't quite make the mark, but also get some really outstanding films that, you know, these people are trying to get their film seen. That's why they enter film festivals, because they aren't picked up yet. They aren't being mass-produced. They aren't going to be in your commercial theaters. So film festival is their way to reach their public. We got a lot of documentaries this year about several different topics. There's a documentary about wine in Spain that was done. There's a documentary about ice fishing. There are several really interesting documentaries, which are some of my favorite films, because you're entertained and you also are educated and learn about something new.
Sure. And though it is an international film festival, River's Edge has always prided itself on featuring local filmmakers as well. Do you have a strong showing from the local region this year?
We do. We've got a couple of films that were in the 48-hour film project that we were in our fourth year doing back in August. So all of those are local people. And we also are highlighting the winner of the Atomic City Student Film Festival, which we finished up our second year doing that here earlier this year. So those are all local. We don't have them in a specific local category, but they are intermingled with all the other great films.
So what does it say about Paducah that, you know, you mentioned this is the second longest running film festival in Kentucky. What does it say about Paducah and Western Kentucky to actually have something like this here? What's the significance of it?
I think the significance and what's fantastic about it is a completely volunteer-run entity. I am the director of it currently. We've had different people do it. Paul Lorenz was fantastic, used to be the volunteer director, and we would all kind of work together to make it happen. So at this point, this is an event above and beyond my daily duties as director of Made in LA Cinema, so I consider myself a volunteer as well, because this is a film festival is something that could truly use a year-long staff. There's lots of things you can do as far as outreach and things of that nature that we want to grow and do, more education, workshops, things of that nature. But really the fact that the community comes together, we have about 100 people from the community that volunteer their time to help us make this happen, which is a testament to how important it is to our region, I think.
You mentioned documentaries, so and maybe this is getting into, you know, choosing your favorite child kind of thing, but is there a film that really excites you this year that you are saying everybody needs to go see this one, this one's fantastic?
I really think that the documentary Between Two Rivers is really, really, really fantastic. And there's also a documentary called 778 Bullets that was submitted by some students from Carbondale, Illinois. And it's a documentary about 1970, around that time, when local police shot 778 bullets into an off-campus rental house. And it kind of gets into the Carbondale Black Panther troop and some discrimination issues that happened during that time. There is a documentary about a group of nurses that travel to Haiti and do good work and help there. And we've got Banjo Bill. It's a documentary about a Kentucky native and who was well-renowned and known for his banjo skills in the 1950s. Oh, I could go on forever. I mean, we really handpick these films and think that they come together to make a really cohesive, great weekend of filmmaking.
Well, Landy Bryant, Executive Director of Made in LA Cinema, thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about the River's Edge International Film Festival, which starts November 1st in Paducah. Thank you so much, Landy.
Thank you very much.
Hitting the barbershop isn't as easy as it used to be here in Western Kentucky. We'll find out why after the break. We'll also hear about the local birth of an iconic piece of Southern gastronomical culture. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton. First off, an announcement. Unfortunately, we are unable to broadcast the Young and Mighty concert of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra this morning at 11 as planned. The next concert of the season on November 3rd, including a performance of the Brooks Scottish Fantasy featuring Pip Clark, violin, will air on WKMS at 11 a.m. Sunday, November 11th. For many, the phrase barbershop brings back memories of a time when men gathered to talk sports or politics in places where the air was thick with snips, buzzes, and the peppery aroma of aftershave. Kentucky has close to 3,000 licensed barbers, many of whom have been in the business their whole life. But their popularity is decreasing as many consumers pick hair salons and chain stores over barbershops. It doesn't help that a barbering education is getting more difficult to find. As Angela Hatton reports, to become a barber in Western Kentucky these days, you've got to really want it.
Big Boy's Barbershop in Princeton is a new business with old-time flair. Owner Joe Riley opened his barbershop in the city's downtown as a place that would capture the feeling of a mid-20th century barbershop. Walk inside and a pot of hot coffee and a stack of newspapers and magazines beckon you to sit down and stay a while. Barbershop memorabilia line the wall above the waiting area, shaving cream brushes, straight razors, and pictures of barbers. Riley's father was also a barber and his inspiration, but it took Riley several years to decide to take up the business. He says it came down to economics.
I've been wanting to do it for years, and I worked at a place that shut down, and I'd worked at about five different factories that shut down, and I decided that was the time.
Riley started with the closest option, the barbering school at West Kentucky Community and Technical College. It was there he found a problem with his plan. The school had closed the program. Vice President of Academic Affairs Tina Payne says the school hated to lose the program, but the economy and a small job market couldn't support it.
That seemed to remain very flat. In fact, our student numbers continued to drop. So in 2009, that's when we kind of were doing a teach out, preparing to close the program. We actually closed it a semester early because we didn't even have any students.
Riley says that left him with limited options.
The only other two that they told me I could go to was either in Bowling Green or in Louisville area. So for people around here that want to get into the training or whatever, you know, that's a long drive.
Riley settled on an out-of-state barbering school in Clarksville, Tennessee. He says he got a good education, but it took longer because while he learned the same skills as he would have in a Kentucky school, he had to transfer his credits to fit Kentucky state guidelines, a process he says took a lot of waiting. Then he set out for the internship that all new barbers have to do once they get their initial license. Riley says that's when he noticed how few and far between barbers are becoming in Western Kentucky.
Because I went everywhere from here to Bowling Green back and forth trying to find somebody let me work under them. Went in a couple of them places and found out most of them are cosmetologists.
A cosmetologist or hairdresser and a barber have a lot of the same skills. The basic difference? A barber focuses on shaving and haircutting, while a hairdresser focuses on haircutting and styling, and may also provide other beauty techniques like manicures. The number of Kentucky cosmetology schools far outstrips the number of barber colleges. Over 60 institutions offer cosmetology degrees, while only 9 offer barbering classes. Because they're in the minority, barbers today recognize that they need to appeal to a wider customer market. Not everyone wants a shave and a little off the sides. Remaining Kentucky barbering schools are teaching more techniques. J.R. Cox is owner and operator of the Barber College of South Central Kentucky in Bowling Green.
When I went to barber school, all I had to learn to do was cut a regular man's haircut and a flat top. And about the only thing they mentioned about hair coloring in school was that some men colored their hair. And now we have to teach in depth men's hair coloring, and we do a lot of women's hair coloring.
Cox says his barbering school keeps up a steady stream of students with a capacity of close to 24. He also offers help with housing for students from out of town to cut down on the expense of commuting to get an education. With so many obstacles and challenges for Western Kentucky barbers, it seems maybe folks like Joe Riley should pick a different industry. Cox disagrees. He says his students continue to want to become barbers because it's an industry with job security.
Kentucky is getting desperate for barbers, but we're picking up more and more people all the time that realize this. They realize their job is not going to go to China or Mexico or someplace like that. And so they realize that once they get into it, it's something they can stay in until they retire.
And for Riley, being a barber is more than giving a haircut.
It's kind of a lost art to me. It's went to chop shops, and a lot of people like them, and that's fine, but it's more of a quick, convenient, cut-and-go type of place, and I feel like you get a better treatment at a barbershop they spend time with you at the place where you can talk and you get a good service.
It's the customers that want that extra level of service, and maybe a bit of nostalgia too, that will keep Riley and his colleagues in business. For WKMS News, I'm Angela Hatton.
Paducah sits a little more than 2 hours from the nearest Krispy Kreme donut shop, and local fans of the brand's glazed treats can only find them here and there in local gas stations. Yet, Paducah is where Krispy Kreme creator Vernon Randolph discovered the recipe for his famous yeast-raised donuts, and where he worked at his uncle's store, selling the pastries from a box on his bicycle. Casey Northcutt has more on Rudolph's impressive and somewhat disputed transformation from humble donut peddler into bakery mogul.
I'm standing by Broad Street in Paducah near a quiet residential neighborhood. Some say that somewhere along this road, Vernon Carver Rudolph and his uncle, Ishmael Armstrong, once sold the donuts now packaged in Krispy Kreme boxes and enjoyed around the world.
Very energetic, very athletic, loved to play basketball. Someone that would be described as adventuresome with a great personality.
That's Brad Wall, Senior Vice President of Supply Chain and Off-Premises Operations for Krispy Kreme. He's describing the originator of his company. According to a short Krispy Kreme authorized biography, Rudolph was born on July 30, 1915, in a rural section of Marshall County. And in 1933, he went to work for his uncle, who had recently bought a donut shop from a man named Joe LeBeau. Wall said LeBeau was
a Frenchman from New Orleans. And with that purchase of that donut store, he acquired the rights for the formula of the Krispy Kreme donut.
That's where the tale gets convoluted. Vernon Carver Rudolph Jr., known as Carver, tells a different story, saying that Armstrong did not have a donut shop, but sold pastries out of his general store. He also says LeBeau's name was actually LeBeouf, and he was not a French baker from New Orleans, but an American member of the United States Corps of Engineers, who hailed from Lake Charles, Louisiana. Carver says LeBeouf made donuts for crews before giving the recipe to his great-uncle. After talking to LeBeouf's family, Carver discovered the old sailor never lost his fondness for the taste of those pastries.
They tell me that his favorite thing was Krispy Kreme donuts, and the kids would bring them to him, you know, special occasions, and he never made the connection between his recipe and those Krispy Kreme donuts.
By 1934, Armstrong's donut business had outgrown Paducah, and he convinced his nephew to move down to Nashville, where they opened a shop using the Krispy Kreme name. Business began to speed up, and Carver said in 1935, Rudolph's dad bought out Armstrong and began to run the pastry business with his son. A little while later, after his brother had also joined the endeavor, Rudolph felt crowded and he broke away to run a store on his own. He traveled first to Peoria, Illinois, and found it brimming with donut shops. Discouraged, he looked down at his package of Camel cigarettes. This is a part of the story upon which both Wall and Carver agree.
About that time, Dad looked at his cigarettes, which he smoked Camels. He knew they were made in Winston-Salem. He knew Winston-Salem back then was industrial capital of North Carolina. Cigarettes were hugely popular, and he just translated that into successful economy and good employment and maybe a market for donuts.
Vernon Rudolph opened his first official Krispy Kreme store in 1937. Carver says that original store in Winston-Salem measured a mere 18 feet wide and 60 feet deep, but Rudolph ran between 5 and 8 delivery trucks out of it 6 days per week. And as more and more people tasted the addicting sweetness of Rudolph's pastries, the business grew. According to his biography, he soon went into business with another uncle and opened up a shop in Charlotte, North Carolina. Then, as Brad Wall says, came years and years of various expansions.
The man was a visionary who believed in having consistent quality. In 1946, 1947, started a mix plant where every donut, still to this day, that's produced all over the world starts out here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in a form of mix or concentrate.
Rudolph continued to open more shops while allowing others to do business under the name Krispy Kreme. By 1958, the company operated stores in 6 states, and it kept growing until Vernon's death in 1973. Facing the operation of such a massive business, Carver Rudolph says his family sold Krispy Kreme to Beatrice Food Company in 1976. Now, Carver isn't sure they made the right decision.
I miss it now, and can't think about it so much. We probably would have done that differently.
In 1982, according to the Krispy Kreme website, early franchisees bought the company back from Beatrice Foods. What began as a small donut business in Paducah is now a publicly owned and traded company, with nearly 700 stores worldwide. Although Paducah residents might have to drive to Evansville, Indiana to sit down at the nearest franchise and enjoy an original glazed, they can bite into the pastry knowing that a taste of Krispy Kreme is a taste of home.
Hi, can I have a Krispy Kreme donut, please?
For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and Dave Chenal. Kate Lochte and Tracy Ross are contributing producers. Matt Markgraf provides website assistance. We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.